Council are all present. We can begin. The next matter on for oral argument is Dunkley versus Hewler. Council, for the record, for the benefit of the audio recording of the proceedings, I will just state that the court today is not holding hearings live at the Minnesota Judicial Center because of the national pandemic, and we're doing so for the good of the public, the parties, the attorneys, and court staff. We are instead holding our conference today by WebEx with none of the parties present together. Given that, I'll just advise counsel that the technology is not perfect. So if we have glitches during the proceeding where you're having a difficult time hearing or seeing any of the other participants, including the judges, please indicate so somehow, and we will try to make sure the connection is resecured. But our rules remain the same. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes for appellant's counsel for rebuttal. Counsel for the appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and can everyone see and hear me okay?
Looks as if we're getting nods from everyone, so yes, indeed.
Very good. Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court and counsel, my name is Andrew Brandingham, and I am here on behalf of the appellants, William Dunkley and Sue Dunkley, to respectfully urge the court to reverse the judgment of the district court and remand this case for entry of judgment in favor of the Dunkleys. The district court in this case, Your Honors, fundamentally erred by reading into the easement instruments at issue restrictions on the Dunkley's property use that simply do not exist under the terms of the instruments or under the law of Minnesota as it governs the use of real property. The district court essentially turned Minnesota property law on its head by giving the easement holders rights superior to and in derogation of the rights of the owners of the property, and erroneously deprive the Dunkleys of fundamental property rights that they hold under the law of Minnesota. The implications of the district court's decision, Your Honors, go far beyond the four corners of this case, because the district court not only erroneously deprived the Dunkleys of their property rights, but in turning the law of Minnesota on its head, the district court's decision introduces uncertainty and confusion and disarray in the Minnesota property law. And so the court should act to correct that error, to introduce uniformity and correct the law of Minnesota, and should act to give the Dunkleys back the property rights that they hold under the law. So we ask that the court reverse and remand the case for entry of judgment in favor of the Dunkleys.
Mr. Brantingham, before we get too far down the road, I want to make sure I understand sort of the lay of the land, no pun intended. I'm looking at page 5 of your appellate brief, which seems to be, the picture of what we're talking about here in terms of the various parcels. And I want to make sure that I'm oriented correctly. As I understand, the north top of the page, I'll give you a moment. Do you have it in front of you now,
Counselor? I'm with me. Yep, I can hear you.
What's identified as Pence Lane, that's the road the county vacated, correct, back in the 1980s?
The city, that's correct. Pence Lane was a road vacated by the city.
Okay, and then we have the gray shaded area that's described as a driveway that sort of curves, and then 3/4 of the way down the curve, there's a part that goes straight down to the 2715 Pence property. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, so when we're talking in the easement, the driveway easement, about the point at which the easement begins and the point at which it terminates, where are those two points on this diagram on page 5? What would be the commencement? Pence Lane intersects the driveway?
That's correct, Your Honor. If you're looking at page 5, it's a little challenging to hold it up on video here, but you can see where the portion that's highlighted hits the corner of where the boundaries are indicated on the diagram. That little spot right there is Pence Lane, and then the rest of that curving property within the boundaries that are shown in the diagram is the driveway.
Okay, and so it would commence then at Pence Lane and terminate. There are two termination points, aren't there, on the driveway?
There is, you can read it that way, yes, or you can see it that way. I mean, it provides access to both the 2715 property, the Hewlers property, and to the 2710 property. So in that sense, there are two points of termination in that it accesses both properties.
Well, one of the things I'm getting at is, to the extent that the easement restricts your client's rights, it seems that it says you cannot change the termination point. Doesn't the proposed modification of the driveway change the termination point?
No, it does not, Your Honor. And the reason is, I think, actually quite straightforward. The easement instrument does speak of a termination point, as you've rightly pointed out. Virtually by definition, there are two points in that it provides access to both properties. The natural reading of that provision in the easement instrument, Your Honor, is that it protects the termination point at the Hewlers property. And we can reach that conclusion for really straightforward reasons. When you look at the instrument as a whole and at the clear purposes of the parties at the time it was made, the point of restricting moving the termination point is to protect the Hewlers access. There is no reason on earth why the parties would have entered into an agreement that would restrict the fee owner from moving the point of termination on his own property. And you can imagine, I mean, if that's really what it meant, the Hewlers, imagine the fee owner were to construct a new garage and slightly move the end point of the driveway on the fee property. I don't think the Hewlers would even have standing to challenge that. There's no reason that the fee owner would agree to that, and there's no reason that the easement holders would care. And so really the only natural and appropriate reading of that provision is that it prevents the Dunkleys from moving the point where the driveway hits the Hewlers property. Why? Because they have an easement right. It's simply to protect their right and keep that spot where it hits their property. That's the natural reading, Your Honor. So if I may come back to
Mr. Brandingham, I have a follow-up question. As you're looking at easement agreement and the description of the driveway itself, you're not saying that description only includes the portion of the driveway that is going straight down to 2715, are you? You agree that every part that's highlighted in yellow is what's described in the agreement. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. The agreement covers, I guess to put it simply, all of the driveway that we're talking about. The one portion is subject to the Pence Lane agreement, what we call the utility agreement in our brief. The other portion is subject to what we call the driveway easement agreement. But it covers
so that I'm clear, as I'm looking at what is labeled the driveway with the highlighted markings, right? It looks like there's a fork, and one part of it branches straight down to 2715 and the other curves. That's both of those parts of the yellow highlighted driveway are described in the easement agreement. Is that right?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, although I'm not sure that the easement agreement provides utter precision with respect to, you know, every foot of the driveway. I'll be honest, I certainly, the district court and the parties, everybody has operated under the understanding that the agreement covers all the property we're talking about.
I just wanted to make sure I was clear on your point, because the agreement does refer to a single termination point. And so I wanted to make sure that you were not arguing that this highlighted portion that curves towards the WPP property was not included in that agreement.
That's correct, Your Honor. I'm not claiming it's not covered by the agreement. What I am saying is that the reference to the point of termination must be and can really only reasonably interpreted as protecting the point of termination at the Hewlers property. That's the only way it makes sense. Your Honors, if you see me dipping down here, it's simply to check the timer that I can't fully see all the way across my room here. So coming back to the core points here, Your Honors, I think there are two issues.
You have
your arms around.
You have slightly less than 6 minutes, just so you're aware, if you're not able to see the clock.
Thank you. Much appreciated, Your Honor. There are essentially two issues that the court needs to address here to resolve this dispute. And the fundamental question, Your Honors, is whether the Dunkley's proposed plan, which contemplates using this driveway to access a contiguous parcel of land that they own, is permissible under the law of Minnesota, under the easement instruments. So there are two issues, essentially. One, the plain terms of the easement instruments. As we've just been discussing, there are two. There's the driveway easement agreement. There's what we call the utility agreement that covers the little Pence Lane portion. The second question is, arises under the general law of real property under Minnesota law. And the bottom line, Your Honors, is that absent explicit, clear restrictions on the Dunkley's use of the land in those easement instruments, the law of Minnesota is simple and straightforward. The fee owners or the tenants in common, as it applies to the two parcels, have the right to use the land in any way they see fit that does not unreasonably interfere with the easement holder's express rights under the agreement.
So I have a question on that last point. Assuming that we agree with you that that is the general law of Minnesota, isn't this a situation where the district court would need to, in the first instance, decide whether there was an unreasonable interference with the easement of the Hoolers or not? I mean, is that a matter of summary judgment?
You broke up just slightly there, so let me rephrase the question and make sure I got it right. Are you asking, does the district court need to make a factual determination whether there's unreasonable interference?
Yeah, I mean, typically that's a question of fact. Why would that be something subject to summary judgment here?
You're absolutely right, Judge. It is a question of fact. And the district court, unless summary judgment were appropriate here, and I'll explain why it's appropriate for the Dunkleys but not for the Hewlers, it is a question of fact that needs to be resolved as a matter of fact. The reason that summary judgment is appropriate for the Dunkleys is because the Hewlers, as the party holding the easement, asserting that their rights have been infringed, has the burden to prove, as a matter of fact, that the Dunkleys have unreasonably encroached upon their rights under the easement. The Dunkleys don't have that burden. They're the fee owners. And so as it arises in this procedural context, the Dunkleys move for summary judgment saying there's no evidence that we've infringed in any way, in any unreasonable way, and they are entitled to summary judgment. The district court denied our motion for summary judgment and granted the Hewlers, and in so doing, it did inappropriately resolve fact issues against the Dunkleys. As we said in our briefs, the district court didn't review any record evidence of unreasonable interference. There is no record evidence of unreasonable interference, Your Honors. The only evidence in the record that even comes close is a few allegations in essentially conclusory and frankly inadmissible affidavits from the Hewlers where they refer to some occasional blocking of the driveway during construction and so forth. That is not enough as a matter of law to give rise to a tribal issue of fact that there is unreasonable interference, and I'll tell you why. The Athanasiopoulos case, and trust me, I practice saying that repeatedly, the Athanasiopoulos case that this court decided in 2018 is straight on point, and it commands reversal and judgment for the Dunkleys here, and frankly, the Hewlers have not even acknowledged that case in their briefing. That's a case that also arose from a dispute over the use of a common driveway with easement rights. And the plaintiff in that case sought an injunction claiming that the other parties were infringing on the easement. And the facts were such that there was, for example, sod encroaching into the driveway. There was occasional blocking of the driveway by service trucks and so forth. There was some inconvenience in that cars couldn't pass each other. Those are similar things to what the Hewlers alleged below. And the district court in that case denied an injunction saying this is not unreasonable interference. And this court affirmed and said, yeah, that's maybe slightly inconvenient, but that does not rise to the level of unreasonable interference. The district court, to be clear, didn't even carry out that analysis. And the Hewlers essentially have said on appeal, well, it must be implicit in the district court's decision that it concluded there must be unreasonable interference here. That's no defense of a summary judgment order, Your Honors, that resolves fact issues against the non-moving party. That's an order that has to be reversed. The district court simply didn't carry out the right analysis. And so we do urge the court at a bare minimum, again, because there is no evidence of unreasonable interference on the record that was complete and is closed, the Dunkleys are entitled to summary judgment as a matter of law, and the court should order that. But at a bare minimum, there's a fact issue here that the district court just didn't grapple with. And at minimum, the court should remand for the district court to apply the right analysis, to look at the facts and say, okay, would this proposed use, which ultimately amounts to nothing more than accessing a contiguous parcel, would that unreasonably interfere with the Hewlers' ability to enjoy the use of the easement? And it wouldn't. There's no evidence that it would. Let me briefly touch, Your Honors, if I may, in the limited time I have left, on the plain terms of the instruments, because I think it's critical, and I'll try to be quick.
And just so you're aware of the clock, you have about a minute and a half, a little less than that.
Thank you, Judge. Let me start with one key conceptual point, Your Honors. The district court's, I think, fundamental error, and when you see this, you see how it infected the whole analysis, was the district court went looking in the instruments for an affirmative grant of rights to the Dunkleys. That's backwards. That's upside down. The fee owners, the tenants in common, don't need an affirmative grant of rights in the instruments. The only issue is whether the instruments restrict their rights, and you can see this at pages 11 and 12 of the district court's order, where it says the Dunkley's rights depend, quote, entirely on the terms of the grant. That is an objective error of law, because that case law the court was citing, the Berg case, was talking about the easement holder's rights. It's the easement holder's rights that depend on the grant, and the fee owners, tenants in common, retain the rights not otherwise granted to the easement holder. And so when we look at the two instruments, I'll be brief. They contain no restrictive language. They do not say the Dunkleys shall not access other parcels. They do not say the Dunkleys are limited to accessing only the 2710 parcel. What they do say, both of them explicitly, is that the easements are non-exclusive. And that's a critical point, Your Honors, because if you look at the Thompson versus versus Germania Life Insurance case, the Minnesota Supreme Court in that case framed the question. That case involved I see my time is up. May I just finish the thought, Your Honor? Thank you.
Yes, please finish the thought.
Thank you very much. The Thompson case involved easement rights among basically three easement holders plus the grantor, and there's a dispute about whether the grantor could bring in another easement holder. And in that case, the court said, okay, the question is whether this is an exclusive easement, exclusive meaning exclusive to the parties at the time of the instrument. And the court in that case held it was because the terms of that grant provided the rights, quote, in common. Our grants, both of the instruments say non-exclusive, and I believe that's dispositive and it's critical. This court to affirm would have to hold that these are exclusive easements, and you can't hold that because they both say on their face they are not exclusive. With that, Your Honors, I'll come back and speak in rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Brantingham. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Tamara Neal Moreland. I represent respondents Gregory and Kelly. This case is about whether a general rule of law can trump written terms in an agreement. Appellants are arguing that a general rule regarding the scope of easements should trump plain language and actual written contracts.
I'm sorry, Ms. Moreland. I'm going to ask you if you can. If you can get perhaps closer to whatever the source of your microphone is, you're coming in and out. I'm not sure where exactly your microphone is in the room. If it's on the keyboard, you're looking at the air. It's on the ceiling?
Yes.
Well, this I got to see.
I will just try to talk louder.
It's much clearer. Thank you.
Okay. While the general rules regarding scope of easements do exist, if there are contract terms regarding the rights of the parties, the terms of those contracts prevail. Easements come in different forms and they're located in different documents. Some are a line item in a deed, some of them are located in restrictive covenants, and some are written in contracts between the parties. When there is just a line in the deed saying the parties have ingress and egress over X, and no terms or conditions, oftentimes the courts do apply a general rule of law regarding reasonableness. However, when there are terms associated with the ingress and egress rights, the court looks at those terms. In Berg, the Minnesota Supreme Court, in a published case, looked at language located in a right-of-way agreement and found that its terms trumped the general rule. The court applied the terms in the right-of-way agreement and stated that the terms therein contained all the rights and responsibilities of the party. Specifically, the court stated, because the right-of-way agreement specifically defines Great Lakes rights and responsibilities with respect to accessing the pipeline easement, we have no occasion to read a reasonableness requirement into the easement grant.
Does it matter that we're talking, can you discuss Berg in the context of which is the dominant estate and which is the servient estate?
The dominant estate is the pipeline, and the servient estate is land on which the pipeline runs. And so what happened in Berg is the easement holder came in and did some repairs, very intrusive repairs, and kind of tore up the whole ground. And the question was it reasonable? Or that was the question that was proposed. And the court said, we don't get to reasonableness because the contract itself specifically states what is supposed to happen here. So we don't apply the general reasonableness rule. We apply the terms of the contract.
Right. So my question is, how does it apply here when the roles are reversed as to the dominant and servient estate?
I don't think it matters that the roles are reversed because both parties are
Why not if the fee holder holds absolute rights and the easement holder holds only those rights that are granted in the easement expressly?
The servient estate doesn't hold absolute rights. When they enter into a contract, and there's a contract that runs with the properties that states both parties' rights and responsibilities, both parties have to live up to them. They can't trump the language in the contract by saying, hey, I own the underlying land, so I can do whatever I want. They can only use their land to the extent to which the parties agree.
Let me ask you this, Ms. Moreland. Look at the 1982, I guess it is, driveway easement. What language in that document precludes the Dunkleys from modifying the driveway that is on their property? The part of the driveway that's on their property.
There are several provisions that do. One is the statement of what the intent of the agreement is. The statement of intent says each of the parties hereto wish to use the driveway for ingress and egress, and for that purpose wish to enter into this agreement. So right there it says both parties are entering into an agreement which sets forth their rights and responsibilities. Second, they define driveway, and they use the term driveway throughout that easement agreement, and they define it to include both branches of the fork. If you look at the legal description, at the very end of the legal description to the driveway, there is the curve to the left and the curve to the right. So they specifically have both termination points. And then they say that both parties intend to use that driveway, and the Hewler property has the right to use it for ingress and egress to the Hewler property, subject, and it says subject to, and this is the only place it says subject to, the right of the 2710 Pence Lane property to use the driveway for ingress and egress. The agreement goes on to say that the owner, the Servian estate, cannot alter the point of commencement or the point of termination.
But as a practical matter, the proposed driveway here seems to me doesn't change the termination point that the Hewlers are interested in, i.e. the point of the driveway that ends at their property, which is the whole reason they have this easement.
But the agreement itself states that the driveway is both termination points. And I think it is incorrect to assume that they're only interested, or the parties who entered into that agreement were only interested in each of their respective termination agreements. It's just as reasonable to read that contract into saying that it doesn't, the other termination point matters because we don't want that to go to another property.
Ms. Moreland, if the property description includes both termination points, but the rest of the document uses the termination point in the singular, wouldn't we have to conclude that there is some ambiguity as to which of the two interpretation points it's referring to?
I don't think that if both parties below conceded that this is an unambiguous contract. So I don't think we actually have to go there. If you look at the actual briefing below, both appellants and respondents specifically called this and conceded it was unambiguous.
Oh, I understand that. I guess I'm asking you to describe for me how, if it has two different termination points, but it is referred to in the singular, how that's unambiguous and referring to two points. because my hunch is Mr. Brandingham is going to say it's unambiguous and refers to only one point.
Well, I think you have to look at the contract as a whole. So it's not just looking at every time they use that in the singular. It's looking at the fact that they define it to include the whole. It's looking at the fact that when they talk about maintenance, they talk about one half. Anytime there can be additional parties to a contract, they talk about proportional maintenance requirements. They don't specifically say one half. It is also important to remember that our interpretation is actually consistent with the city ordinance, which is the law that controls this driveway.
Right, and that's why I'm asking the question about ambiguity, because I don't know that we can look to interpreting the easement in a way that is either consistent or inconsistent with city ordinance unless we first find that that easement is ambiguous.
Well, I think you can look at how the parties who entered into the agreement intended the agreement to work.
Again, I don't think we can look to parties' intent if we have an unambiguous contractual or easement language. I think we're left with the unambiguous language. Only if it's ambiguous do we then look to things such as what the parties said as they, you know, parole evidence or other evidence of their intent. And only then can we look at whether an interpretation is consistent, right? I mean, aren't we left with the first question is it ambiguous or not?
But I do think that the Supreme Court has said that you put yourself in the position of the parties at the time they entered into, negotiated, and executed the agreement. And I do think that putting yourself in the shoes of the parties at the time does allow you to say, okay, the one interpretation complies with the law and the other one doesn't. And so the parties at the time when they were entering into this agreement most likely entered into an interpretation that actually complied with the city law. And I do think that's acceptable, and I don't think that's looking to extrinsic evidence.
Ms. Moreland, if you could continue to speak a little bit louder, it would help us to hear everything you're saying.
I'm trying to speak up, so if I look silly, that's what I'm trying to do. I do want to touch upon the road easement agreement too, because we really haven't talked about that. And
I'm sorry, before you move off of the driveway, I just want to make sure I understand it right, that the grantor, the owner of the driveway, is the Dunkleys. Is that right?
The owner of the driveway is not the Dunkleys currently.
I agree. Let's put aside the standing issue, but at the time that we were focused at the district court, it was the Dunkleys who stood in the shoes of the Plumes, and it was the Plumes to whom the Murnicks sold or gave the driveway, reserving this one easement to themselves, and then the Murnicks sold to the Hewleys. So the Dunkleys stand in the shoes of the Plumes, who were the owner of the driveway, to oversimplify it. Is that right?
That is right.
Okay, so if the Plumes had wanted, could they have issued a new easement to the owners of WPP, the Walters Point property, without consulting the Murnicks?
No, they couldn't have.
Could they have informally permitted the owners of the Walters Point property to use the driveway without an easement and without consulting the Murnicks?
No, that those two parties had an agreement and they both were bound by the agreement. They don't.
So what does it mean? So what does it mean then, the language that the easement that the Plumes gave to the Murnicks was non-exclusive?
Anytime more than one person, being the dominant in a servient estate, use an easement, the term non-exclusive is put into the contract, because you're not granting somebody the exclusive right to use this driveway for ingress and egress, because you have to use it yourself. And so non-exclusive is in any easement that more than one person is using. It does not mean that it's open free game to everybody and their dog. Um, Just touching base on the road easement agreement, I do want to be very clear about the road easement agreement, because Pence Lane, the road, you actually have to travel on that to get to said driveway. And the road easement agreement says that the parties, their successors and their assigns, grant a perpetual non-exclusive easement for roadway purposes over and across Pence Lane for ingress to and egress from, and then it defines three properties. One is the Randall property, which is the third party. One's the Hewler property, and one is 2710 Pence Lane. That easement agreement between those three properties specifically says ingress to, egress from three identified properties. There's no way that appellants can get around the fact that they cannot use Pence Lane.
But aren't they also the three original grantees, if you will? They were also given ownership of the vacated land as tenants in common. Doesn't that provide the Dunkleys with some ability to provide others to use the driveway that comes off of the Pence Lane?
It does not. The party specifically stated that, having now succeeded to the ownership of the properties, desire to create and affirm easements and obligations herein stated. Just because you own a piece of property doesn't mean that you can't contract your use of that property. Once you contract your use of that property, you have to abide by that contract. To rule otherwise would be make all easements optional at the part of the landowner. And they're not. If you agreed in a contract to do certain things, you have to abide by that contract if you call it a contract or if you call it an easement, because the courts have determined that easements are contracts. I guess my time is up.
Your time is up, but you will. Yes, your time is up. Thank you. Mr. Brenningham, any rebuttal? I believe you're muted.
I haven't completed a Zoom conference yet where I haven't made that mistake. Thank you, Judge. I'll start with a basic point. I agree with Ms. Moreland on one conceptual point, and that is, yes, the fee owners can contract away their rights, but they didn't. They didn't do that here. And we'll look at, I'll come back in a moment to the plain terms of the agreements in a bit more detail. Let me pick up on a question regarding the meaning of non-exclusive, because Ms. Moreland suggested that non-exclusive appears in any easement that still allows the fee owner to use the right of way. With respect, that's wrong. And this court has explained why precisely in the APITS case that we cited in our brief. And in the APITS case, the court was considering an easement instrument that purported to grant the easement holder and, quote, exclusive easement. And the court said, gee, that's a very unusual grant, first of all. And it cited some case law from another jurisdiction explaining that almost never do we see an easement that gives the easement holder the right to exclude the fee owner, because as you can appreciate, that's pretty close to granting a fee interest. There's almost no easement that exclude the fee owner, because that's hardly an easement. And so this court said in APITS that merely using the term exclusive in the easement instrument is not even enough to exclude the fee owner. And in fact, the court held there that term was, in that context, ambiguous and remanded. So non-exclusive almost definitely means, and here in this context, I would say it does definitely mean more than simply that the Dunkleys or the Plumes can still use their land. Of course they can still use their land. Non-exclusive means other easement holders, other properties can also be given rights, and that's what Thompson tells you. Go back to Thompson. On the plain terms of the agreements, Your Honors, I'll come back to first principles, because we've addressed the distinct terms in our briefing. Do not lose sight, please, of the basic principles that govern here, because what the district court did and what the Hewlers are doing on appeal is essentially adopt a principle that says, well, if the instrument identifies, you know, a particular goal or a particular use that the fee owner might make, then the fee owner's stuck with that, and that's all they can do. This easement instrument doesn't say the Dunkleys can walk on the driveway. Does anyone seriously think they don't have the right to walk on the land that they own? This instrument doesn't say that the Dunkleys can go and have a picnic next to the driveway. Does anyone seriously think they don't have that right? The point is that the underlying principles are that, number one, we do not expand the easement holder's rights by implication or by interpretation. Number two, the law favors unrestricted use of land, and any doubts are resolved in favor of unrestricted use of land. That's the Mission Covenant Church case that we cited in our brief. And so at the end of the day, you look at both of these instruments, they're expressly non-exclusive. They do not use any restrictive language. They do not say the Dunkleys or the Plumes shall not, must not do X, Y, and Z. They do not say they shall only access 2710. In fact, the easement agreement, where it says that the right of the Healers is subject to the Dunkleys' right of ingress and egress, doesn't even say ingress and egress to which parcel. It just says ingress and egress, period, full stop. Both agreements also refer to the Dunkleys, or the, as it were, the Plumes, successors and assigns, which contemplates not just successors in title, but assigns in the sense of the ability to assign rights to other parties, which makes perfect sense for a non-exclusive easement that gives the Healers nothing more than the right to come and go from their house as they please. At the end of the day, what you're left with is a decision that essentially assumes that the Dunkleys, that the fee owners, are stuck with only the uses that are expressly identified in the agreements. And as I said at the outset, that turns the law on its head. One last point on the road easeway, the road agreement, Your Honors, is yes, it identifies the three properties. Again, it does not use restrictive language. And the district court held that the Dunkleys can subdivide and convey their interest as tenants in common, which is correct. And the Healers don't challenge that holding. And that holding is inconsistent with the district court's assumption that the Dunkleys are somehow restricted in their use. If they can bring in another tenant in common who has the right as a tenant in common to use the property, surely they themselves can use the property in a way, again, that does not unreasonably interfere with the Healers' rights. At the end of the day, the Dunkleys have never unreasonably impeded the Healers' ability to come and go. Their proposed plan does not impede their ability to come and go, and there is no evidence that it will. And because the district court inverted the law, we have here a grievous error, I think, that is threatens to cause problems in Minnesota property law. And for that reason, we urge the court to reverse and remand for entry of judgment for the Dunkleys.
Thank you, Mr. Brantingham and Ms. O'Neill Moreland, for your argument today and for your briefing in this matter. We do take it under advisement at this time and will issue our opinion within the statutory period provided.
Thank you.
So thank you both. We are in recess.